Now, the push to vaccinate people against COVID-19 continues to slow down around the country. That comes as Republican lawmakers nationwide work to protect those who are unvaccinated. Arkansas and Montana now have laws banning private and public entities from discriminating on the basis of COVID vaccination status. That creates a protected class effectively on par with race, gender, and religion. In addition, 8 states have banned so-called vaccine passports. Wisconsin Assembly Republicans have also passed such a measure. It would still need to pass the Senate, and Democratic Governor Tony Evers has suggested he would veto the bill. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do Republicans in states around the country have the right idea here, or should we be doing whatever we can to get as many people vaccinated as possible? Should unvaccinated people be a protected class? If you're unvaccinated, have you felt discriminated against? Should businesses be able to say unvaccinated people can't shop here, or they have to be subjected to different restrictions like mask wearing than vaccinated people? What do you think? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. James Hodge is the Peter Kiewit Foundation Professor of Law at the Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law and Director of the Center for Public Health Law and Policy at Arizona State University. His areas of expertise include public and global health law, ethics, and human rights. James, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Rob, it's a real pleasure. Thank you for having me.
From a legal standpoint, do we have a lot of precedent for these kind of vaccination restrictions and laws restricting them?
Listen, we've got hundreds or actually dozens of years of precedent for what you're seeing happening on the vaccination front right now. In other words, there's a lot of cases and a lot of litigation around vaccination policies ever leading up to COVID-19 and will continue to be throughout the remainder of the pandemic. And what those actually go on to say is that we can and will, under circumstances, require vaccination among specific persons and set specific limits on who can do what based on whether they're vaccinated or not.
A lot of the questions now, it seems like, center around, can this institution, whether that's a family restaurant or a cruise line or a university or you name it, set their own vaccination requirements for their customers and or employees or students in some cases. What does case law tell us about whether they can do that?
That's such a great point, Rob. It seems like it's very almost destination specific or entity specific in relation to what and how far we can go with vaccination policies. Part of that is because there's a little bit of truth to that. Now, listen, there are specific entities that can set vaccination mandates in the United States that will have strong legal support for doing so. Let me give an example, a hospital, in relation to what and how they may actually have to require or at least expect their employees to be vaccinated prior to be engaged fully with COVID-19 patients or any patients for that matter. Federal standards all but require that to provide a safe workplace. Now contrast that with a retail enterprise that might set a vaccine mandate, just to make sure that their employees and customers, don't potentially spread COVID-19 within that specific setting. It's a little different environment, as is a cruise ship, as is an airplane, as is a train. That's why we have different mandates and different requirements around vaccine that start to look very dissimilar. But there are different risks in each of those environments, and the vaccine policies that have been built up over time reflect those key differences.
Now, let's look at the government itself. Can the federal government or a state or local government say, you live here, you got to get vaccinated, maybe there's some waiver wiggle room there? To what extent can the government mandate vaccines?
Well, this is such an important point. Let's make a critical distinction right now. It's so important for any listener to understand. Can government forcibly require you to get vaccinated in the United States, especially with an authorized vaccine not approved? And that is, FDA's authorized these several COVID-19 vaccines. They've not been fully approved because we haven't had the time to vet them closely. Hey, the reality is legally, no, you can't be forced to take a vaccine. You're not going to be physically restrained and given a vaccine by any legitimate public health authority in the United States at the federal, state, tribal, or local levels. But that's not the same as a vaccine mandate. Compelled vaccine is forcible vaccine. Okay, we can't do that. Can we mandate you to get a vaccine? What does that mean? It means we're setting a condition on you returning to society or participating in this activity, going to the Milwaukee NBA game or otherwise. We're setting a condition on you being able to do those activities. And that condition is you're vaccinated. So you want to return to work? You want to go to the University of Wisconsin-Madison? you want to attend, you know, your school as a kid age 14 to 17, states are setting vaccine mandates and private employers doing the same because they can legally. That's very distinct from a compelled vaccine. And should you ask Rob, you know, how far can we go with that? We can go very far. U.S. Supreme Court has even affirmed that we can set vaccine mandates in the United States at the state or local level. So right now we have Supreme Court precedents allowing that to occur.
Talking to James Hodge, professor of law at Arizona State University, looking at state laws in the works or passed in some places, limiting employers' abilities or stores, say, abilities to set vaccine requirements for their patrons, their employees, their students, you name it. Join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Okay, now, James, say I'm a business owner in a state where the state government said, hey, you can't discriminate against someone based on their lack of a vaccine right now. And I think, well, I think it's necessary to protect my health, my employees' health, my customers' health. If I challenge that in court, how likely is it that I'm going to be successful?
It's a great question. These cases will arise soon. And reason for it is that, you know, we're about to see, I think, a new wave of COVID-related infections due to the Delta variant, due to a very systematic group of Americans still yet to be vaccinated, even though very eligible candidates. And what's the claim? The claim is I'm an employer trying to operate a safe workplace for myself, for my employees, for my customers. And I can't, in some ways, discriminate against persons who are unvaccinated. I can't keep those persons out. Okay, we've got state laws that say that right now. But your ability to set other requirements may be part of what we're anticipating as well. Maybe you can't keep unvaccinated people out of your business, but in some of these jurisdictions, you can require them to wear masks by requiring everybody to wear masks. You can create social distancing in your restaurant by actually creating it. It's somewhat returning back to some of those same norms we saw in the harshest parts of the pandemic. But that's what it takes to actually make your business safe for employees and customers as well. We might see some employers actually have to do it. The alternative is not good. Literally having to go back to virtual operations. That's not a good alternative. I think that's what you're going to see, litigation around what and how far we expect employers to create those environments and what they can do in eliciting statements like that to customers about expectations there. It's about to come to courthouses near you.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Michael is with us in Elroy. Michael, hi.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm enjoying your conversation. I'm 69, my wife's 68, and I'm living in the same household with my parents who are in their 90s. So we were able to get the vaccines early, and we chose to do so. And I cannot believe with the experience that this country's had with polio and smallpox before that, that people are reluctant to go ahead with this vaccine because it just makes sense. Can you explain where this reluctance comes from and what we do to combat it, please?
Michael, thanks a lot for the call. James, we've talked about reluctance on other conversations. I don't know if you want to weigh in on that, but go for it if you do.
No, absolutely. Gosh, Michael, let's be clear. First of all, I applaud you and your parents getting full access to vaccines thanks to the federal, you know, doling out to Wisconsin and every other state those resources. It's been a phenomenal achievement to have a vaccine available within a 10-month period of time for a deadly, you know, stealthy condition like COVID-19. Why isn't the rest of the nation joining you? That's a great question. There are several highlights to that. First of all, there are legal opportunities for them not to get vaccinated. In other words, we have seen some legal reticence among political actors to actually utilize the full breadth and extent of law to actually mandate those persons to be vaccinated. Second, there's the vaccine hesitancy phenomenon that's just been horrendous over the last 20 to 30 years, and COVID-19 is, you know, sort of showing it to us nationally on a very big scale. People are hesitant to get vaccines, especially ones that are viewed as experimental, like these authorized vaccines instead of the ones fully approved by FDA. They're concerned and scared about things that are both myth and reality about the vaccines themselves. And I think a third factor is, listen, we all have seen in Wisconsin, here in Arizona, where I'm at, the politicization of COVID-19 and just how much we've seen people respond and react to various different requirements and or public health initiatives based on pure politics. I would hate to think that that's what's stopping some persons from getting vaccinated, but dare say it's a working theme across the United States.
Michael, thanks for that call. We're looking at a push by Republican state lawmakers around the country to protect people who are unvaccinated from vaccine requirements at businesses or public facilities, universities, you name it. James Hodge is with us, professor of law at the Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law at Arizona State University. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you like the idea of state laws saying, hey, businesses, colleges, whatever, you can't treat unvaccinated people differently than vaccinated people? Or do you think business owners, say, should be allowed to make those distinctions? What questions do you have about how the law works on this stuff? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. The conversation continues coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk on anti-discrimination bills. Republican state lawmakers around the country are pushing for unvaccinated people. Arkansas and Montana have signed into law measures that ban discrimination on the basis of COVID-19 vaccination status. Other laws are in the works in other states around the country. James Hodge stays with us, professor of law at the Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law and director of the Center for Public Health Law and Policy at Arizona State University. You can join in with your thoughts on that idea, that kind of law, those kind of protections for people who aren't vaccinated at 800-642-1234. Let's go back to our callers now with James in Oconomowoc. James, hi.
Hi there. I'm calling. Thanks for taking my call. I'm calling because a prior person had called in and questioned why people would not want to take the vaccine and thought it was outlandish that anyone would not want to. And I just wanted to give two reasons, non-political, why people are hesitant to do that. The first one is religious reasons, in the sense that people don't want to take a vaccine that is derivative from a stem cell research, which is from, you know, decades ago, whether it's a, you know, distant relationship or however they want to phrase it. The simple fact is we wouldn't have that capability if it didn't come from those specific cells. And on a religious standpoint, people won't do that. And number two is just that this vaccine is not like other vaccines. From what I've done my research on, they normally inoculate you with some kind of live, like a flu shot or a live version of that virus or dead version, but it's a part of that virus versus this one that actually changes your DNA, changes your RNA.
James, thanks for the call. Last point is inaccurate. We've heard from a lot of doctors that doesn't actually happen. But James's first point is very interesting. James, we've heard a lot of times vaccination requirements, including at schools, will sometimes allow for a religious exemption. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, good point. And what James mentioned there before about that second point is one of those myths. If that's what's keeping people from being vaccinated, that needs to change, of course, with better information you're seeing from federal and other sources to try to make sure we dispel that myth. Now, as to the first issue, neat point. You know, if religious reasons are what are keeping Americans from getting vaccinated, the question legally is, well, can they exert those legal or those religious interests as an exemption or an exception to vaccine policy? Let's be clear on this because, gosh, what a great point and very critical time to mention it, because right now, as we speak, most states would recognize some religious exemptions to a lot of different vaccines. Not every state, though. Big ones like California and New York don't any longer because of measles outbreaks there, but most states still do. And the question would be, would you be able to exert a sort of a religious exemption or exception from any vaccine mandate that would be coming down the wires? And actually, under federal and state law, in many cases, right now you would. But here's what's neat about those specific exceptions. They're not grounded in U.S. Supreme Court approval. The U.S. Supreme Court has never affirmatively said you have a First Amendment free exercise right to reject or accept vaccine mandates from a constitutional perspective. If we've done so, it's pursuant to state or federal legislative authority, and many do that, of course, as well. The Supreme Court may be poised to change that. You've seen a lot of interesting cases out of the Supreme Court recently affirming First Amendment free exercise interest. We think there may be a case before the court in the near future where the court has to actually issue a statement, and it may actually come down on the wires to say you now have a recognized First Amendment free exercise interest to religiously object to specific vaccine mandates. Now, that would get interesting very fast because I think a lot more Americans may uptake that. It would really make it difficult to implement a wider swath of vaccine mandates across the board.
Thanks a lot for that call. We'll go to Chad now in Janesville. Chad, hi. Chad, are you there?
Yeah, there we go.
Okay, yeah, go ahead, Chad. What did you want to bring up?
Well, you're talking about certain laws creating a protected class for those who choose not to get vaccinated. To me, that's just an absurd idea that, you know, choosing not to get vaccinated is a personal choice versus all of the other protected classes. That's something you're born with, you know, race, sex, sexual orientation, and to be able to create special laws for people that could, you know, potentially endanger people's lives just on someone's personal choice just seems like a potential, you know, slippery slope of something that could lead to, you know, even more dangerous situations.
Chad, thanks a lot for the call. What do you think of that comparison, James, between not getting a vaccine as a personal choice and therefore not needing a protected category?
Yeah, I like what Chad's saying there. Listen, it does look very different. It is quite different from other protected classes that the court and others would recognize under constitutional norms. But of course, these are legislative choices. Mm-hmm. Legislatures can make those choices. I don't agree with them for good reason. They're antithetical to protecting the public's health. And we cannot protect the public's health against a stealthy condition like COVID-19 if we have too many persons accepting from vaccine-related anticipation or expectations. That's what's happening right now nationally. And without greater sort of uptake of vaccines that are already proven to be safe and efficacious, and, you know, all of the factors you would look for in a really great vaccine product like what you're seeing right now, if we don't get more persons taking it because state legislatures and others give them, you know, literally legal authority not to take it, you're only going to have preventable deaths and morbidity related to it. It's a horrendous outcome, and it's totally due to that level of protection for persons who just don't want to have to take the vaccine.
Chad, thanks a lot for calling in. We're talking to James Hodge, law professor at Arizona State University, looking at the idea of protections being passed in some state governments, mostly by Republicans, saying, hey, businesses, universities, whatever, you can't discriminate against people, ban them or make them do wear masks or things based solely on their unvaccinated status. Heard from a lot of people on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Want to share one or two of those. Catherine compared requiring vaccines in public spaces to non-smoking rules, adding that not getting vaccinated is not a personal choice when that choice affects others, children, immunosuppressed, those having cancer treatment, etc. Catherine says, we got rid of smoking in public places because it affects others. James, from a legal point of view, is that part of the conversation here, that the vaccine isn't just about protecting the vaccinated, but the people around them as well?
Yeah, it's a totally legitimate legal argument. It's a nice comparison in some ways, too. It's about doing one thing versus not doing one thing, action versus omission. But her point that she's made there is quite apt. It's not just about you. Your choice to be vaccinated has repercussions for your whole community. And when too many Americans choose against, you know, what we know to be an efficacious public health intervention, we can't protect others that don't get to make that choice. Like she was saying, there are immunosuppressed individuals and others who cannot lawfully and or medically be vaccinated. It actually would adversely impact them for sure, guaranteed. And the Supreme Court's made clear you can't require those persons to be vaccinated. It's really about placing persons in that status. If you don't get herd immunity, which is basically a nice way of saying, if you don't achieve a sufficient level of vaccination across your community, persons who cannot be vaccinated, those are the ones who really lose. They can't circulate in population because of choices made by otherwise healthy persons, simply on political, religious, or other objectionable or other grounds.
We heard from a caller who couldn't stay on the line who asks about privacy issues and mentions HIPAA, which stands for the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act. It includes some privacy measures in it when your health data is shared. Is this a violation of our health privacy rights if somebody, when I walk into a store, is saying, hey, Rob, are you vaccinated or not?
Such a great question, because everybody, you know, I hear a lot of that on the privacy issues. Everybody thinks it feels like one, and they think that the HIPAA privacy rule, which we're all referring to here, certainly would stop that. It doesn't remotely stop that, and it doesn't protect you under that circumstance. The HIPAA privacy rule is about what a hospital has to do to protect your privacy and some other what we call covered entities, not what a store clerk has to do or what your neighbor can't ask you or what you can't disclose on Facebook or otherwise. And that's why Americans have been told many, many times, be careful about what you put out there in social media. your privacy interests don't go too far if you put it out there. So, yeah, people can ask you about it. You just don't have to respond if you don't want to.
In just our last minute, as we mentioned, a lot of states working on this. A lot of courts are going to be involved. What is at the top of your list, James, and what you're watching for next?
What we're really watching for is just how far we can go in that balance that's at work right now, Rob, between, you know, government insisting and working hard to actually reach herd immunity through vaccination policies that have standard, approved, longstanding legal backing, as contrasted with other policymakers who are out to make sure that no American is subjected to anything that remotely feels like a vaccine mandate, including passports, you know, just requiring proof of vaccination under certain circumstances. That balance, where and how far that'll be reached, whether we're looking at minority views that come into play and become more considerable, is exactly what we're watching in court-related settings and legislatures across the country, because the health of several hundred thousand Americans is at stake.
James, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
That's James Hodge, professor of law and director of the Center for Public Health, Law, and Policy at Arizona State University. We talked to him today about a push by Republican state lawmakers, especially in red states, to pass bills that would give unvaccinated people similar protections to those surrounding race, gender, and religion. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, supporters of the new child tax credit say it could lift millions out of poverty. But can the president get enough support to make this temporary fix a permanent one? Join Jen White for that story today at 6 on 1A+. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with the answer to a Wisconsin audience question about Rib Mountain.
There's a rumor that Rib Mountain in central Wisconsin is an extinct volcano. It seems somewhat reasonable. You can see it from miles away, and there are volcanic rocks all over the city of Wausau. Well, it's not. It never was. And although it does have ties to ancient volcanoes, the star of Rib Mountain's story is a rock too tough to break. Liz Domes Harder brings us the story.
You could say Rib Mountain in central Wisconsin has stood the test of time. I'm not talking about its ski hill that has been open since 1937, nor the state park that's been there for almost a century. I'm talking about something much older.
The rock that makes up Rib Mountain is called quartzite. It's a very, very hard rock, one of the hardest on Earth, and it's estimated to be about 1.7 billion years old.
That's Scott Spoolman, a science writer who lives in Madison and literally wrote the book on Wisconsin's rocks called, well, Wisconsin Rocks.
That's 1,700 million or 17 million centuries old.
So this stuff lasts. But where did it come from? Mark Janowiak from New Glarus has wondered a lot about that.
You know, I'm a Wikipedia expert on Rib Mountain, so I learned, three things about it.
Janowiak and I both grew up near Rib Mountain and spent plenty of winters skiing its slopes. He sent in a few questions to Wisconsin about Rib Mountain, and they got me curious, too.
Is Rib Mountain volcanic in origin? How big was the, if it is, how big is the, like, the volcanic range?
There were four volcanoes in the Wausau area 1.8 billion years ago, explains Lisa Seward. She's a senior lecturer of geography and geology at the University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point. But Rib Mountain wasn't one of those volcanoes. It was the hard rock underneath one of them.
Underneath volcanoes are magma chambers, and those magma chambers brought up a bunch of this super-duper hard rock that we call quartzite.
Spoolman explains where that came from.
It's originally sandstone. It's ancient sandstone, and it was deposited by ancient seas, and then it was eventually buried under other sediments and then mashed by continental collisions that caused unimaginable heat and pressure and metamorphosed that sandstone into the very hard rock called quartzite.
We can get a sense of how big the volcano was. In the footprint of one of those old volcanoes are three quartzite blobs: Hardwood Hill, Mosinee Hill, and of course, Rib Mountain.
Think of the size of Rib Mountain. That is a quartzite blob.
Keith Montgomery has some good analogies. He's a retired geography and geology professor who lives in Wausau.
You can think that the mountains that existed here would have been similar to Mount Rainier or Mount Baker those kinds of mountains, so several thousand feet, maybe 10,000 feet above the local terrain.
For comparison, Rib Mountain is 650 feet above the local terrain. The mountain range that stretched across the upper Midwest and into Canada quickly eroded away. Spoolman explains.
There were no plants or animals, so everything was eroding almost as fast as it was growing.
Still, weathering was no match for Rib Mountain's quartzite. But what about glaciers? Genoviak had a question about that, too.
Because one thing I read is the glaciers kind of went around. It didn't go over the top. Or did it go over the top?
There's been four major glaciations in the last million years or so. And pretty likely that three of those four did cross over Rib Mountain.
The most recent glacier stopped short of the mountain. The other three before it might have scraped off some chunks. Lucky for those of us who enjoy the mountain, that quartzite is one tough rock.
WPR's Liz Domes-Harder brought us that story on Rib Mountain. She answered an audience question as part of the Wisconsin Project. Submit your question and we might answer it in a future Wisconsin Life segment. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, the U.S. housing market is red hot in many communities, and after recent news reports, some worried that part of the problem could be blamed on Wall Street investors competing against average home buyers. But our next guest says investors aren't really driving high housing costs. The bigger issue, low supply of housing. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you having trouble buying a house right now? If so, what has it been like? If you're on the seller side of the equation, were you able to sell a home for more money than you expected? As a renter or homeowner, would you support more housing in your community to bring down housing costs? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Jerusalem Demsis is a policy reporter for Vox. Jerusalem, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Before we get to the investors and the supply issue, I mean, is this really happening around the country? Red hot markets, prices going nuts?
Yeah, prices have increased substantially over the last year due to a number of factors, including low supply of housing. Of course, mortgage rates have been really low, and we've seen a lot of people enter into the housing market. Millennials have been entering into their prime home buying years and are, you know, looking for single family homes, of which there are not that many in key locations.
I've talked to guests who have written about these investors, these Wall Street finance type companies getting into the single family housing market, buying homes and then renting them out. A big Wall Street Journal piece that you referenced in your reporting drew a lot of attention to this, went a little viral. Who are we talking about, first of all, when we talk about these, you know, business investors getting into this housing market?
Yeah, it's really important to figure out what we mean when we say investors, because a lot of the time what people are concerned about are, as you mentioned, these giant Wall Street firms, things like BlackRock or Blackstone, entering into the single family home market. And what we have right now is not a lot of data, but what we do have is data on investors as an entire class. And what that means is anyone who is not purchasing a home for their primary residence. That could be someone buying a second home or a vacation rental. It could be small investors flipping homes for profits. It could also be iBuyers, which are a new thing that have entered the market where, you know, investors who can make instant cash offers on homes and then sell them soon after. So it can also be mom and pop landlords, people who are buying a second residence to be able to rent it out. So what we've seen is that there's been an increase in investor activity as a whole, but there's not a lot of evidence that there's all of a sudden a gigantic increase in institutional investors and private equity firms actually entering the market.
Yeah, that's kind of been the story. Some people have been telling that these big institutional investors, they're buying up so much housing. That's kind of driving pricing millennials in particular out of the market. You looked at the percentages around the country of how many of these houses. Mm-hmm. Your conclusion is they're out there, but it's not the big part of the story. Can you expand on that?
Exactly. every expert I've talked to has talked about the low supply of housing in the United States as being a primary driver of the housing crisis that we're seeing over the last year. There's Freddie Mac has calculated an almost 4 million home shortage nationwide that has increased by nearly 2 million over the last couple of years. So that's really, when we have fewer homes and you have more people entering the market, millennials are the largest generation in American history, you're just going to have a larger group of people bidding on the same amount of properties, and that's going to increase prices because sellers know that they can sell for higher prices because there's more people than houses. So, and then looking closer at the numbers here, people, we've cited research, the most recent one we have about how many institutional investors there are, so private equity firms included in that, is around 300,000 single family units in 2019. It's unlikely that's increased that much, and that's compared to roughly 80 million single family homes in the United States. So it's really hard to believe that on a nationwide level, these kinds of actors could really be driving the crisis.
And you write that there's kind of a chicken or the egg thing here, that maybe it's not institutional investors are getting into this market and driving up costs. It's that institutional investors see a shortage of housing and see an opportunity to make some money from it.
Yeah, exactly. So, of course, what we're seeing, and, this is in official documents from, there's this group called Invitation Homes, which is one of the largest buyers, owners of single family homes in the market. And what they're looking for is places that are restricting supply. And so, in their documents, they'll write that they want to ensure that the value of their asset increases over time. And the way to make sure that a value of your asset increases over time is to keep it really scarce. So they're going to communities that are already restricting housing supply, that are making sure it hard to build any type of housing, whether it's market rate, affordable housing, public housing, any type. And they're trying to buy in those areas according to this financial document that they filed with the federal government. So it's pretty clear here that if you are really concerned about this trend, and there are obviously good reasons to be concerned, the best way to combat it is to increase the supply of housing in these high demand cities and ensure that, people can continue to own homes without the fear of being outbid by giant corporations.
We're talking to Jerusalem Demsis, policy reporter for Vox, with us today to talk about accelerating housing prices, the role institutional investors play in the housing market, and in just a bit, we'll get in more into the local zoning laws and how they can limit supply. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Love to hear maybe your personal experience if you've been in the housing market buying or selling or being a real estate agent. Love to hear what you're seeing in your community when it comes to housing prices, how fast houses go, how long it takes to find a house that you can afford. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our look at the housing market and what effect investors are having on it. Jerusalem Demsis is with us from Vox. She says the big part of the story is lack of supply, and in often cases, local zoning codes that make it hard to build new housing. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What do you think? What are you seeing if you are participating in the house buying or selling market? 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Jerusalem, can you talk a little bit about what's happening in a lot of cities and other communities around the country when it comes to making it hard to build new housing stock?
Yeah, for sure. And this is really the big problem driving our housing crisis today, and has been for many years. As most, I'm sure, of your listeners know, housing has become unaffordable even before the pandemic began, and a lot of these trends really took off. But essentially, almost all cities and places in America have rules about what kinds of houses can be built and where they can be built. Some of these rules make sense. You don't want to be putting schools right next to polluting factories or things like that. But some of these rules were put in place without housing affordability in mind. Things like making it illegal to build a duplex or a quadplex, or making it illegal to build a small single family home or a single family home within 10 feet of the sidewalk. And what happens when you have all of these rules that make it harder and harder to build smaller homes and more affordable homes is that you get unaffordable homes. So in a lot of the country, despite there being a really large profit incentive for people to be even able to sell their own homes and turn those into duplexes or triplexes or quadplexes, it is illegal to build these kinds of things in a lot of the country. And what we've seen is, as a result, there's been marked lack of supply, not just in the most high demand cities, but in the outlying suburbs that are really attractive places for people to live, places with good schools, places near good jobs. And it's really creating a crunch in a lot of the rest of the country. As you know, as California's housing prices rise, we've seen people moving to places like Phoenix, Arizona, or at Austin, Texas, or Miami. And that creates a massive price pressure there, as those people coming from different states usually have higher bidding power. So this is really a national problem that is beginning in a lot of high cost cities.
Let's bring on a caller now. Ron is with us in Eau Claire. Ron, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to tell us about, Ron? Yeah, go ahead.
My comment is that I took a new job in the Eau Claire area back in November and have been in the market since. And I'm walking around with triple 800 plus credit, a pre-approved $275,000 mortgage paper, and every home I've looked at, people are paying over list, $10,000, $20,000, $30,000, and there are 10 to 20 parties at every listing on day one. So it's been a very tight market, and I'm going to drive for a while.
All right. Ron, I'm glad we could be with you there on your commute. Good luck to you in shortening it in the near future, hopefully. Jerusalem, Ron, not alone, right?
No, not at all. And this is, I think, the big story here is that due to this, you know, lack of supply, you have all of these people with really good credit ratings and, you know, everything that he just told us about having, unable to make a purchase on a home despite being available on paper to it. And, you know, it's a really bad situation, because you, instead of having a lot of the pressure be put on local governments to increase the supply, you kind of have these free-for-alls at these houses. There's been a lot of reporting of people waiving inspections, of placing $100,000 over asking price. There's one viral anecdote of a woman promising to name her firstborn after the seller if they chose her bid. And, you know, that's a really unhealthy market. And a lot of the time you're getting a lot of animosity being placed at the feet of other people who are trying to buy homes, other people who are outbidding you. But the real thing is that this is a false sense of scarcity that cities have engineered, and they can reverse that if they would like.
Thanks for the call, Ron, and good luck. Joshua is with us next in Milwaukee. Joshua, hi.
Hello.
What do you want to tell us about, Joshua?
Yeah, I'm looking for some context about what feels like predatory home buying. In the last year and a half, I've owned my home for about 5 years, and in the last year and a half, I've been getting text messages, phone calls, sometimes multiple times daily, asking if I would like to talk about selling my house. They've even gone so far as to call my elderly father looking for me to buy my house when I've never put my house on the market, have no intention of selling. I don't know how they get my number or what list I'm on. Is there some context for that?
Joshua, thanks for the call. Jerusalem, I think I've heard of this, people getting postcards in the mail, things like that, saying, hey, let us know if you want to sell your house now, even for people who have no interest, like Joshua, in selling their house now.
Yeah, no, this is, you're not alone, Joshua. This is becoming increasingly the case, especially as the home prices rise in value. And a lot of times people are getting these calls because the government has started collecting a lot of data around who it gives mortgages to, and in good faith wanting to do that. But a lot of scammers have been able to get a hold of that. And even other people who aren't scammers, but are people who are just looking to purchase houses. But it can be very predatory, as Joshua mentioned, and you get people on the phone who are elderly, who are, you know, other folks who are susceptible to being scammed for whatever reason. And it is really unhealthy, and there should be more steps taken to ensure that it doesn't continue.
Thanks for the call, Joshua. We're talking to Jerusalem Demsis from Vox, talking about the hot housing market in the United States, what is driving it. And Jerusalem, another piece you wrote looked at what the Biden administration is calling for. Congress would have to work on this as well, I believe. But what kind of proposals are we hearing?
Sure, yeah. So there are quite a few proposals on the supply side. So in terms of trying to figure out how to build more homes and how to really deal with the supply crunch, one of the ones that the Biden administration has proposed is creating a $5 billion pot of money, which states and localities could compete for. And the way that they would be able to get that money is if they reduce some of the regulations at the local level that are making it really difficult for people to build enough housing to meet the current demand. And, you know, it's an interesting idea. I think it doesn't probably meet the moment. Most experts I've talked to have said that it is probably a small but important first step to addressing this problem. There is also money that they're hoping to spend as part of the bipartisan infrastructure framework that would begin to rehabilitate and potentially build more affordable housing units across the country, whether it's through tax incentives and credits for developers or through more direct payments to public housing authorities at the local level. So there's some ideas there, but a lot of this action is going to need to come probably at the state level, at the very least, to make sure that localities are not onerously restricting new housing supply growth for whatever reason. And so that's really where most of the action is going to be need to be had.
And Jerusalem, let's talk about the local politics here, because you have a built-in constituency. If someone owns a home, they'd like, for the most part, its value to go up, apart from, I guess, property taxes. They want to see that that asset increase in value. If lots of new housing pops up and the demand goes down, it might decrease in value. So you've got this built-in constituency, right, to limit housing.
Yeah, I think a couple of things here. One is that there's a complicated economics of what actually happens when you build more homes, and researchers are still really looking into this. You're right. If there was all of a sudden, you know, hundreds of thousands of new homes on the market in one location, of course we would see property values drop. But if you really think about what would happen if tomorrow, let's say, you were able, all of a sudden you're a single family home neighborhood, and you were able to turn your single family home into a duplex. What would occur is that a developer would come to you possibly and would say, hey, I'm willing to buy your home for actually a lot more money now, because instead of renting it to one person or one family, I can rent it to two. So in a lot of cases, we could actually see home values rise if we are upzoning, is what they're calling it, when you allow for more density inside of a unit of land. But as to your broader point of, you know, people's concerns about property values, that's really a lot of what's driving this here. And you know, I think the problem is a lot of times cities, you know, they don't make the trade off between, you're right, maybe people won't see their house prices appreciate as quickly, but on the other hand, you could increase housing affordability. There's a lot of economic research that shows wages can increase. Over the course of 30 or so years, America lost billions of dollars in GDP due to these regulations, and it would have amounted to nearly $3,600 a year for the average American worker if these regulations were lifted. And, you know, that's quite a bit of money for people. That's like $300 a month that we're talking about increasing in the wages of the average American worker if these regulations weren't stopping people from moving to places where good jobs were, or not having to spend as much money on long commutes or on increasingly high rents.
Jerusalem, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
That's Jerusalem Demsis, policy reporter over at Vox. She was with us today to talk about investors in the housing market and a scarcity, a lack of affordable housing, and why the market is so hot now. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 7:30, if you're spending time in a boat this summer, there's a lot you can do to make it safe and fun. A water safety expert joins the show with advice and answers to your questions. That's tomorrow at 7:30 on The Morning Show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then the Surgeon General is calling on social media companies to do more to deal with COVID-19 misinformation online. We'll find out more about how that misinformation spreads and what else internet platforms could do to stop it. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.